It's 12 o'clock, Newfoundland Standard Time. Stay tuned for The Great Eastern with Paul Moss. You are listening to the Broadcasting Corporation of Newfoundland, 520 on the long wave.
The BCN Christmas party was held yesterday afternoon, and I almost didn't go. Don't get me wrong, I'm on good terms with my colleagues, although the crowd in the newsroom still harbors some unspeakable grudge. No doubt because of the time that's a different story. No, it's just that I'm sworn off the booze. Remaining sober while around me, my workmates descend into a state of exorbitant intoxication, leaves me feeling that those with whom I spend most of my waking life are morons. And so, as I heard the first sounds of Yuletide cheer break out in a plastic cup down the hall, I slid into my coat and headed surreptitiously for a side door. Instead of offering a safe escape, the door opened onto the ruddy face of Gunnar Olaf Mundensen, head of children's programming at the station, a great northern Swede much given to flights of Yule. Ah, good. Give me a hand with these rundles of spiced punch, Polly. I pretended I had my coat on for no other purpose, because I knew that if I confessed I was on my way home, Gunnar would question my Christmas spirit in that aggressive way Swedes are given to. I hated that. How often had I been shamed into giving myself up to the Republic of Christmas? I decided to avoid the shame this time by being a willing volunteer. "Heave away, Gunnar," I said, and we hauled the casks of aquavit and herring wine from the hatch of his old Drodge Dingus down to the cafeteria, temporarily converted into a wet bar. By the time we arrived, Jingle Bell Rock was in full swing, and director of radio Ish Lundgren was doing his traditional stint as bartender, getting the party off the ground with masterfully poured triples. I ordered a soda, wandered the main floor, and watched the ritual unfold, an anthropologist amongst the natives of Christmas. Polite chit-chat had already been left for dead. Suppressed libidinal urges were rearing their ugly heads in every direction, only to be welcomed like old friends. In the crowded lobby, I spied mild-mannered technician Hollis Duffett licking the bare shoulder of newsroom prom queen Wanda Barrett. Helen, the severe middle-aged receptionist from accounting, emerged giggling from Studio G, lipstick smeared and trailing the unmistakable perfume of reefer, a young apprentice technician in tow, somewhat the worse for wear. Back in the cafeteria for a soda refill, I found Gunnar arm in arm with his arch-enemy, Sirius music producer Hermann Stimmel. They swayed back and forth as they wooed the ladies with a lewd version of Come All Ye Faithful. It could even be heard as far away as the photocopy room, where some of the station's most conscientious servants had gathered to uncharacteristically immortalize themselves.
"Look at this."
"That's impossible. You enlarge that."
"Oh, yeah? Enlarge this."
As I watched these honest, humble drones photocopying their derrieres, it dawned on me that the office Christmas party was a great release, a magnificent carnival. When bosses served their underlings and heard painful truths about themselves, when enemies buried the hatchet, when ages were dissolved, and when unutterable desires were heard without consequence. The crowd at the copier beckoned me.
"Come on, Paul. Let's see if what they say is true."
And so I abandoned my academic stance, seized the moment, and leaped into the fray. Alas, the toner had run low, but I will always hold on to the memory of their incredulous laughter as that warm beam swept across my nether reaches. And then, still savoring the afterglow of my epiphany, I made the truly wise decision to slip out the side door and head for home before the party turned ugly.
Repeat the sounding joy, repeat the sounding joy. wonders of his love, and wonders, wonders of his love.
I've been involved with some form of show business most of my life. From radio sports to early Newfoundland guerrilla theater to Mexican cinema and the soul-destroying cancer that is television. I got my start on the school stage, the pageant, the panto, the concert, the Christmas show at St. Matthew's. And even there I started at the bottom, literally, as the back half of a two-boy donkey in a nativity scene. The part of the donkey's forequarters and head went to Junior Stoyles, who, in the strange ways of small-town life, works here at the BCN in finance. But there was no doubt who the show's star was, Ruthie Bambrick. Ah, Ruthie Bambrick. She, like me then, was big for her age. I in the baritonal zones and Ruthie a striking soprano. We'd rehearsed the show a dozen times. There was little for me to do besides hold on to Junior Stoyles' belt loops and keep my head down. However, I didn't miss a single rehearsal, because at the show's climax, Ruthie, as the Virgin Mary, stood right beside the donkey and sang. Her voice, her beautiful, angelic voice, it did something to me that I didn't understand at the time. Something spiritual, aye, but something physical, too. Something very... Anyway, night of the big show comes. I'm cool. My father is bored, reticent, smelling of fermented cane, and my mother is in cardiac distress. She is so nervous for me, so pleased that her boy is going to be in a show. Mom, I said, I'm the back half of a donkey. No small role, she says. Off to the school we go. Backstage, Sister Mary Rebecca, the director, is as bad as Mom. You wouldn't know, but we were opening on Broadway. But then for Sister Mary Rebecca, I suppose we were. She checks me and Junior. Can Junior see all right? There have been some problems. It's okay. Don't fidget or get on with any donkey business during Ruthie's solo. She's nervous enough as it is. Okay, no business. Let's have a look. No, something is wrong. Our trousers are gathering at the knees inside the costume. The pants will have to come off. The sister will get us some tights. Tights? Girls wear tights. Shakespearean actors wear tights, sister tells us. Be that as it may, sister, we're not. And with that, she picked us both up off the ground by our hair. Tights it was. Me and Junior are in the wings. We get our cue, and on we waddle. Our scene is flying by, taking place in showtime. Moments are expanded, and somehow the quicker in passing. And suddenly, Ruthie is singing. She's so nervous, she does something she's never done in rehearsal. She reaches out and steadies herself against the donkey. Puts her trembling hand on the donkey's rump. Inside there, the heat, the velour of the costume, the tight grip tightening, a stirring, a fire I've never felt. I've got to slip out from underneath Ruthie's touch, lest I burst. I shimmy forward, coming up against Junior. But Junior has remembered Sister's entreaty not to move. I pull closer to him, and I guess in the process, I give him a little poke. And what a fright it gives Junior. He bucks and bolts, tearing the costume in two. Suddenly, the stage lights are blinding. I stagger, the rear quarters of the cotton donkey rolling down my legs and my shame revealed to the entire auditorium. Through the many gasps, I could distinguish one in particular. Mom's. Never forgiven me. Never. The shock was quick remedy to my condition, and many wonder if they saw what they thought they saw after all. Not Junior Stoyles. He can't look me in the eye to this day. Ruthie Bambrick, the still stunning mother of six and high school French teacher, laughs about it now. And whenever I bang into her downtown or up at the mall, she never fails to bring it up.
One, two, three, four.
Jan Peter Francis Moth. Or if you do any business here in St. John's, Frank Moth. Big Frank Moth. My brother. Frank's a wheeler dealer, an experimenter in enterprise. He sold fishing tackle, distributed adult magazines, organized discount vacation packages to Indosamnesia, brokered cheese. If you've dealt with him, you will never forget his ebullience. This is his natural condition. He is a happy lad, in love with life. So you may be surprised to know that Christmas always finds Frank in a black funk. Frank has been diagnosed as having a seasonal emotional dystopia. Why? Well, Mom puts it down to the coincidence that bad things have always happened to Frank around Yuletide. True, he suffered a nasty shock from a bad set of Christmas lights back in 69. He did get ptomaine poisoning from some Christmas turkey that had gone off when he was in the army. And granted, Moth Ultrafeeds declared bankruptcy on Christmas Eve, 74. But that's not it. No. Now, the roots of Frank's problem go all the way back to 59. That Christmas, more than anything, Frank, aged 11, wanted a new pair of skates, and not any skates. He wanted a pair of black, and only black, CCM Tackleberries. No other skate would do, no other presents were requested. This, despite the fact that my parents had repeatedly told him we could not afford such dear skates. I recall Mom saying over and over, "What else would you like, Frank?" He only wanted the Tackleberries. At night, Frank and I could overhear Mom and Dad arguing about it. Mom was inclined to consider it, Dad not. "I'm not mortgaging the house to buy a pair of skates that are going to last the boy 3 months." Well, Dad was right. We were growing like weeds. "Paul can use them next year," countered Mom. "Paul? Paul? On skates? The boy can barely walk, let alone skate." It seemed certain that Frank was not to get his wish, and by Christmas Eve, I think Mom had adequately prepared him for disappointment. Then I entered the equation. How mean kids can be. We were safely tucked in bed. Frank's eyelids were getting heavy, and I whispered across the room, "Frank! Frank! I saw the presents. You're getting the Tackleberries." He didn't squeal with glee. He didn't jump up and down. He simply smiled a beatific smile of peace and contentment and drifted off to sleep. The next morning, he bounded downstairs, tore the wrapping off a big box, and found inside a winter coat. And a pretty tulle one at that. He didn't display any emotion whatsoever. He merely thanked Mom and Dad with an ice-cold courtesy that was far beyond his years. Before you judge me, I should say that there were many salvos fired in the struggle between us siblings, and that Frank, too, could be cruel. He buried me alive for a week. He twice caught me on fire. He later had sex with one of my girlfriends, but I confess, the Tackleberry deke was the most vicious stroke. And why do I tell you this now? Because last week, I dropped into our local antique dealer, the Brace and Splinter Reliquary, selling off some of Dad's Old Norse artifacts, and there I spied a vintage boxed pair of never-worn black Tackleberries, pressed $600. And you know, if I didn't hold a deep conviction that Christmas has grown too commercial, I would have bought them for my brother Frank, whom I love. Merry Christmas, Frank.
Calendar, 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 cal
My fabulous aunt on my mother's side, my Aunt Betty, was an almost mythic figure of fabled stature in our family during my childhood in the early 50s. Aunt Betty had married a boy from Halifax in March 1915, and as tragedy has a way of touching every family, he volunteered for the army the following month and gave his life on the barren vistas of the Western Front in Ypres, aiding the kibosh of the German menace in Europe. Betty was understandably heartbroken. Married for a month before the husband enlisted, a very short honeymoon in Quebec, and then nothing. She never remarried, resigned herself to a childless, manless spinsterhood, draped herself in dark velvets, and remained an old woman from the time she was 21. But 40-odd years later, when Frank and I and our cousins knew her, we weren't privy to this history. We just loved the lacy mantillas, the liver-spotted hands with the swollen veins, the handkerchiefs stuffed up her sleeves, the sturdy, stern black shoes. Though she had no children, Betty loved them. One of the highlights of the Christmas season was the annual nieces and nephews party at Aunt Betty's grotto, as we called it. The crew arrived piecemeal and scattered about the house. We'd then be retrieved from out of the cupboards and bathrooms and lost again as we filtered to the basement, been found messing around with the furnace, and saved. And then, finally, all collected into the drawing room. Then Aunt Betty, seated like a queen above her court, would speak to us. "Do you know what I got for Christmas?" she would ask. "No, Aunt Betty. What did you get for Christmas?" "I received a huge box of glorious chocolates." "Ooh," we'd coo. "Would you like to see them?" "Oh, yes, Aunt Betty, yes." "Paul," she would say, or Ethel, or Rosemary, every year a different child, "go upstairs to my bedroom, and on the dresser you will find a large box of chocolates. Bring it down to us, would you, my dear?" The appointed child disappeared out the hall and up the stairs. We could hear the tiny feet through the ceiling, imagining the journey to the bedroom, the sight of the box, and the careful return to the throng. "Thank you, my dear," she'd say, always the courteous one. Then she'd hold out before us the hugest, thickest box of chocolates any of us had ever seen. Whether it was our imaginations or reality, the box seemed to get bigger every year. We all inched closer to her. She'd work off the cover. Out slipped the map, the one that showed you where the hard caramels were so that you didn't have to poke your thumb through everything else to find them. And then the ruffled sleeve would be removed and revealed to all an array of glistening globs. The deep, dark, dusky hue of bittersweet chocolate. The lighter luster of the most favorite milk chocolate. And the chalky pearlescence of the acquired taste of sweet white chocolate. We conjured up mental images of chocolate-robed nuts and nougat, toffee and Turkish delight. We were practically in her lap by now. "Aren't they beautiful?" she asked. "Yes, Aunt Betty," we answered, hardly drooling at all on the cousin in front. "Yes, they are beautiful." "Yes," she said, "they are." And then back in would go the sleeve, and then the map, and on would go the cover. "They are beautiful chocolates. Now, dear, bring them back to my room and put them back on the dresser." Every year, the same drill, and never a chocolate for any of us. It was only after Aunt Betty died in 1995 and I was helping Mom sort out the estate that I found the box of chocolates, still intact, still on the dresser. They were chocolates of the highest quality, I realized. Belgian chocolates. A Christmas gift from a lonely infantryman, away from home for the first time, to the young wife he'd left behind. On behalf of every one of the wonderful people who work here at the BCN, I'm taking this opportunity to wish you and yours all the true peace and happiness of this season. Our address is 342 Duckworth Street, St. John's, A1C1H5, or you can email your greetings to us at greateastern@stjohns.cbc.ca. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and be safe.